Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So there's a lot of talk today when it comes to peace in the Middle East. Hamas responding to the latest plan for a new ceasefire and a hostage release deal with Israel. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is there again. He's meeting with Israeli leaders to discuss the plan today.
I do believe that there is a very positive, powerful future that is possible that genuinely integrates Israel into the region and addresses its most profound security needs, to be able to live in peace and genuine security, and also answers the aspirations of the Palestinian people.
So, I mean, that's the balance that needs to be struck, right? And if you followed this conflict over the years, as you know, the two-state solution has often been held up as that is the way that we get to a lasting, permanent peace for the region. And, you know, today marks 4 months since Hamas carried out the terrorist attack of October 7th, which sparked what I think is by far the most severe round of violence in that region in decades. 4 months now of pretty much relentless fighting. And this, as we say, goes back years and years and years, where peace has proven to be incredibly elusive. And as I say, the two-state solution has always been talked about. It's never been achieved, though. You would think, at least I would, given where we are now and what's happening, the two-state solution seems farther away than ever before. However, maybe it's not. Maybe it's actually closer than before. We're going to speak with Benjamin Case, a postdoctoral research scholar at the Center for Work and Democracy at Arizona State University. Benjamin, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's just talk about the concept of a two-state solution. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. It's been around for a long time. What would it look like if we were ever able to achieve it?
Well, that's a fantastic question, and I think it's one that not a lot of folks have been able to honestly answer, which led a lot of people to say that the two-state solution was a mirage, that it was really dead. Various versions of a two-state solution along the 1967 border, which was the borders of Israel in 1967 before war with its neighbors, where Israel occupied the Gaza Strip in the south and the west, and the West Bank and Golan Heights in the east and the north, and have held those territories in this sort of netherworld between independence and being part of Israel, right? These are territories that Israel militarily controls, but where the Palestinian people who live there don't have any rights in Israel, voting rights, you know, human rights, anything like that. And so this is a situation that has been widely understood to be unsustainable, but there hasn't been a way out. Israel claims granting sovereignty to the Palestinian territories would be a security risk. And so we've become stuck. I think you're right that this round of violence really, I mean, excruciating to watch. And so this is not even from afar. So this is certainly not a silver lining. But political violence like this can have paradoxical effects.
Right.
They can draw urgency.
Exactly. It can sort of get us to a point like, okay, how is this going to end? And how are we going to make sure it stays ended? Because that's been part of the problem. You draw an interesting parallel to South Africa. And I just came back from South Africa last week, and I spent a lot of time talking to people about apartheid. And of course, it still hangs heavy over that country 30 years later. But walk us through the similarities. And they're pretty obvious if you spend a minute thinking about what's going on today in this part of the world versus what was happening back in the late 80s, early 90s in South Africa.
Yeah, there's some interesting confluences between the two countries. Even, I mean, you know, the term apartheid gets used by human rights groups for Israel and Palestine now. Of course, South Africa is the country that's bringing genocide charges to Israel at the International Court of Justice. So I thought, let's look a little bit deeper into this analogy. And it turns out, yeah, there are really interesting similarities for how apartheid collapsed. The apartheid system, of course, apartheid is a Afrikaans language word that means apartness or separateness. It's legal segregation that was enforced in South Africa between 1948 and the early 90s. And the collapse of apartheid is usually attributed to some combination of domestic resistance to social movements in South Africa to bring it down, and to the international boycott movement, which isolated South Africa. Both of those are absolutely true. But there's another factor that isn't talked about very much, which is what South Africa called their border war in Namibia and Angola, which are next door to the west and the north of South Africa. There was a war that was sort of a low-level proxy war being fought in Namibia for a number of years that South Africa was involved in. There's a lot of history here. I don't want to take up too much time with it, but Southwest Africa had been a German colony until the end of World War I, where it was occupied by British-controlled South Africa, and they maintained this occupation, and they enforced their apartheid policies there and became involved in a war against forces that were fighting for independence. That war spilled into Angola after they achieved independence from Portugal. That became a civil war. So South Africa just became more and more embroiled in these wars, trying to maintain its control. It took more and more resources. It became a proxy war for the Cold War. The United States came in to support South Africa politically and financially. The Soviet Union was supporting independence fighters in Angola and in Southwest Africa, which is now Namibia. Cuba actually, in a really fascinating historical episode, sent more than 30,000 troops and tanks to fight on the ground in Angola. So it started spiraling out of control into a war that nobody wanted and nobody could sustain. South Africa was doing a lot to try to insulate its white citizens in South Africa from what was going on. Mm-hmm. But as the war escalated, they had to mobilize tens of thousands of reserve troops. It became clear this was sustainable, and people started asking questions like, what are we really doing here? There started to be protests among white South Africans. The war kind of, as it came to a head, it forced the peace deal. South Africa withdrew its troops. And in that political crisis, the prime minister lost the support of his own far-right party. He resigned. That brought up a lot of other questions about the direction of South Africa. They started rolling back apartheid policies. And as we know, historically, Nelson Mandela is released from prison. He wins the first democratic elections in 1994. So the war kind of brought to a head the system that was unsustainable, was unjust, in a way that got people to ask much deeper questions about what their country was doing, and resulted in really deep changes.
And you're so right in terms of the similarities, the war, the international pressure that is now mounting as this has to end and we need to come up with a sustainable solution. And there is that same internal pressure that you mentioned. Netanyahu is facing that as well. He's having a hard time holding things together within Israel, right?
That's right, absolutely. And there's protests within Israel by the families, yeah, and supporters of the families of these hostages who've been captive in Gaza, more than, I think, 130 still, saying that the Israeli government has not done enough to bring them home. They're rejecting deals to bring these people home because they want to continue the war effort. And similar to South Africa at the time, not all of these protests are, they're not talking necessarily about the condition of the occupation. They're talking about, hey, why are our people being hurt? Why are our people hostages? Why are our people at risk because of this? But that can lead to much deeper questions.
So, I mean, I guess that makes the case then that, hey, we might actually be closer to forcing a permanent lasting two-state solution than we have been before, because, like you say, that sense of urgency is there.
That's right. I mean, the United States is the largest player internationally, of course. And, the United States has verbally supported a two-state solution for a long time, but also continues to send enormous amounts of funding, billions of dollars in military funding to Israel. And takes political action to veto United Nations resolutions that would call for taking action in Israel and Palestine. But all of a sudden, it's again the possible escalation of the war in Yemen, in Lebanon, is now getting the United States to ask questions like, well, is this really in U.S. security interest to continue this? Maybe now actually the pressures are outweighing the possible benefits of unconditional support of Israel. And that's exactly the kind of thing that could lead to tectonic changes.
Interesting. It's perfect because that's exactly what they're talking about today. What's the answer? What's the solution? The two-state solution has to be part of it. Saudi Arabia talking today. They won't even open negotiations. So you're right. We may well be actually at a point where it's just become unsustainable and we might actually move this down the field for the first time in a long time. That would be fantastic.
Tell me about it.
Well, let's hold out hope. Benjamin, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.